Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we're beginning a series of conversations this month about criminal justice in America. We're going to explore why the number of women in prisons is rising so quickly, why so many defendants end up plea bargaining their cases, and what justice looks like in the Native American community, on reservations and off. You're going to hear from judges and advocates, attorneys and activists, and I hope you'll join in too. Today, we're opening the series with a look at private prisons. The Justice Department announced last summer it would phase out the use of private prisons. We're going to talk about why, but that could mean as many as 22,000 inmates in 13 private prisons will be reassigned. And yet, Immigrations and Customs are expanding their use of private prisons to house undocumented people that are coming into the U.S. over the border. And we'll talk about the implications of that. So as our guests join us this morning, I'd like to hear from you. If you're an attorney or a corrections official with some experience with private prisons or corrections, what role do you think they serve in our justice system? And if you or a family member has been incarcerated in a private prison, how do you think that experience differed from a state-run prison? So I want to hear from you if you have corrections experience and you have a view on private prisons. And I'd also like to hear from you if you or a family member have been incarcerated in a private prison. How do you think the experience between the private prison and a state or community-run prison differs? Here's the phone number on that, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Steph Curtis is at nprnews.org/live. You can get in on the conversation there. And I'm on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. David Dayan is one of our guests. He's a freelance journalist. He's the author of a book called Chain of Title, and he's been writing about prisons and privatization, and he's with us today from NPR West. And David, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Arjun Sethi is with us. He's a writer, civil rights lawyer, and an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown, and he's with us today from Washington, D.C. And Arjun, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I also want to tell you that we reached out to three different private prison companies, and they were unable to provide a guest for the conversation. Arjun, in August, as you know, the Deputy Attorney General at Justice wrote a memo about reducing the use of private prisons for the federal government. And she said that although private prisons had been useful at one point, quote, time has shown that they compare poorly to our own bureau facilities. They do not provide the same level of correctional services, programs, and resources, and they do not save substantially on costs. Now, is there evidence to support those assertions that she made?
Absolutely. Time has shown that private prisons do not provide the same level of care and programming, do not save on costs, and don't provide the same level of safety and security as federal and state-run prisons. I would nevertheless make the point that this announcement was ultimately a policy of prisoner realignment, not reduction.
What does that mean? Yeah, the difference.
It means that it only impacts 22,000 prisoners in 13 private-run facilities, which only represents 1% of the total incarcerated population.
David, here's something that surprised me as I read up on this. It appears to cost more money to incarcerate a prisoner in a private prison than a public one. Does your research bear that out, and why would that be?
Well, the difference between a private prison and a publicly run one is that the private prison needs to take out some of that money off the top for their profit. So even if they bid lower, they need to add on to that in order to make it worthwhile for them. So there's just a difference in obviously in a publicly run prison. There's no profit motive. There's no need to skim off the top. And so if you want to provide the same level of service and you add that layer, The math just is very hard to work out unless you're radically cutting costs at that privately run facility. And my research has shown that that is usually the tactic that these companies try to take, whether it's giving out one blanket instead of two, or keeping the heat low, or you know, whatever they can do to cut costs. That's usually what they do. And the sacrifice there is safety. It's security, and it's also just the basic standard of living and standard of service provided to the inmates.
Yeah, and David, I guess one of the confusing things about that is that when the federal government in some states initially turned to private prisons in the 80s, wasn't the appeal that these private prisons could be run more effectively and more efficiently, and they wouldn't cost the state more money to house these prisoners?
That was the rationale.
Okay.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, that was the rationale, that they would be cheaper and more efficient. It's sort of the rationale underpinning all forms of privatization, the idea that the private market can always and forever provide these services more efficiently and more cheaply. Experience has yet to bear that out in all circumstances, and the private prison industry is just another example. And you know, that layer of profit that goes on top is a big reason why.
So, Arjun, in your view as well, it is all about the fact that these are private companies, and as David suggests, they need to make some money, and that's why what they promised really didn't end up being fulfilled.
That's exactly right. These are for-profit corporations, in many cases publicly traded company, and publicly traded companies, and what they're interested in is their bottom line. And often that means rationing things like toilet paper, low wages, which means constant staff turnover, not enough blankets. We've just seen this experience repeated time and again.
I want to put a few numbers, some context, I guess, around this when we're talking about prisons. I took a look at the combined revenues of CoreCivic and the GEO Group. They're actually making a lot of money. Their combined revenues for 2015 were more than $3 billion. Are they reinvesting, David, a lot of that profit back into the facilities themselves? And who regulates that, I guess, is the other question.
I don't know that I would say that they're moving that money back into the facilities. That they're moving that money into their shareholders' pockets, certainly. CoreCivic and GEO. CoreCivic was called CCA up until a couple months ago. But mm-hmm. those two control about 75% of the private prison market. So not only is this a privatized set of entities, but it's a monopoly or an oligopoly. There are two companies that control most of the market. And so there's not a lot of competition, you know, in the private sector for, you know, new techniques or new ways of going about managing these facilities. It's really about radically cutting costs and by limiting services. And it's a very profitable business, as you say, even though federal prisons, which is what the Sally Yates memo was about,
right,
is a relatively small part of their revenue base. They're really very diversified companies.
So Arjun, when the federal government in some states, including Minnesota, by the way, where we are, were turning to private prisons, were they putting requirements about the level of services that these prisons were going to have to provide for inmates that were coming, you know, out of federal prisons or coming out of state, you know, correction systems?
I would say, in my opinion, those conditions were extraordinarily opaque. And that's why we've repeatedly found that private prisons are ripe with abuse. So one of the problems has been not just that they're a monopoly, but also that there is a lack of accountability. And I do think that the DOJ announcement reflects that lack of accountability.
How so?
Simply because we have, again, seen, right, that with time, there have been plenty of lawsuits filed by inmates at private prisons alleging mistreatment by guards, abuse by guards, lack of safety, lack of access to adequate health care, Again, some of the cost-saving mechanisms, right? Not enough blankets, not enough security guards. Security guards who are constantly being trained over and over again because of low wages and because of regular staff turnover. The other point I wanted to make in relation to what you just asked is these companies are very smart. And the other thing that they are increasingly investing in is what some call not the prison industrial complex, but the treatment industrial complex, meaning as the movement for criminal justice reform has gained momentum, there has increasingly been interest in rehabilitating inmates and allowing more prisoners to be released and to be available and to go on parole and probation. And what we found is that private prisons are doubling down on things like monitoring technologies, ankle bracelets, so they can actually capitalize on that movement away from punishment towards rehabilitation.
David, I read the series that you wrote last year, and I pulled out a part that Arjun has just referenced here. You said private prison companies can prosper whether the incarceration rate expands or lowers by controlling the other ends of the pipeline, from pretrial supervision to post-prison reentry. The greatest source of profits now comes from federal contracts to detain, transfer, and deport undocumented immigrants. The more toxic the immigration debate becomes, the more advantage for for-profit corporations to take. I want to talk about how Immigration and Customs is using these prisons, but to what Arjun just said about, you know, parole and transportation, on the face of it, what's wrong with that?
Well, Arjun's absolutely right. These are very, very diversified companies, and there's nothing inherently wrong with it if they're providing, you know, a service that the public is benefiting from. If they are doing the same kinds of activities with respect to post-trial supervision or ankle bracelets or whatever diversification they've gotten into, that they've been accused of repeatedly with respect to the corrections facilities themselves. In other words, underinvesting, not giving the inmates, you know, the proper care or security that they need, then you just have the same kinds of problems spilling out elsewhere. That would reflect, you know, something that I think would not serve and benefit the public. You know, these are companies that have been very nimble in trying to figure out where the public mood is, where with respect to criminal justice, and then capitalizing on it. And every dollar that they take out that is profit for them and their executives and their shareholders is a dollar of public money that could be reinvested in making the system stronger.
This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, that's the beginning of a series on the criminal justice system. We're going to revisit a lot of different elements and dimension of the criminal justice system through January. But we're beginning with private prisons. As you've noted, you've heard us talking about here at the beginning of the discussion, the federal government announced earlier this summer, I think August, that they would phase out the use of private prisons. We're taking a look at how the federal government has used private prisons, how states like Minnesota have used private prisons, the concerns that have been raised about the quality of the incarceration, the quality of the services, the money that these companies bring in, their movement into some of these other areas of criminal justice, and taking a look at what that actually means, what it means for taxpayer dollars invested in corrections. David Dayan is one of our guests. He's a freelance journalist. He writes about these issues. And Arjun Sethi is with us. He's a writer and a civil rights lawyer and teaches law at Georgetown. I'm asking you this morning and getting some feedback here on Twitter. If you're an attorney, you're a corrections official, you're someone with some experience in our correction system, what role do you think that private prisons serve in our justice system? And if you or a family member have had some experience in a private prison, how do you think that experience differs from a state-run prison? Phone numbers here, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. I tweeted out a question that asked, do private prisons serve an essential role in our correction system? And Mary tweets back, they cause incarceration to be treated as a commodity. Prisons shouldn't be private, corporate, or capitalist. Criminals are human. Is Arjun, is that some of the concern that you would bring to this as a civil rights lawyer, that maybe this is a responsibility in our society that shouldn't be commoditized? Is that it?
I think that's a very fair point. I do think that incarceration is a mechanism of last resort, and it is something that should only be done and administered by the state as a last resort. As a civil rights lawyer and just as a citizen, I'm very uncomfortable with private companies whose incentives are profit to be operating facilities that incarcerate Americans or undocumented immigrants, because, again, it creates these perverse incentives. The purpose of, penitentiary, right? It comes from the word penitent, to rehabilitate. The purpose of prisons, is to rehabilitate. And we should be hopeful that people who go through prisons can go in and out quickly. But when a private prison is in the mix, they have every incentive for that prison to stay in, for that prisoner to stay in the system, because the longer that they stay in the system, the more money they make off that prison.
Let me grab a call here from James in Minneapolis. Hi, James. How are you thinking about this?
Well, the point I wanted to suggest was that the private prisons are actually more nimble with their ability that, your guests illustrated, to transition from an incarceration model to a home monitoring or, surveillance model, a treatment model. A federal or a state prison is going to have an entrenched government union that's going to be almost impossible to dismantle, versus a private, which can react quickly and efficiently to the changing rehabilitation model.
Yeah, the landscape there. David, that's a fair argument, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a fair point. Certainly here, I'm in California, and the corrections union is very powerful. However, the corrections union has, in recent years, relented in terms of things like sentencing laws and guidelines, and they have worked in a partnership with the government here in the state to come up with models that will reduce the overcrowding that has affected and afflicted prisons here in California. So it is a fair point, but you want to make sure that those types of non-incarceration facilities are not something that is where the cost is borne on the not just on the state, but on the individuals. Because one way in which private prisons make it look like that they are a good bargain for the government is by shifting those costs to the incarcerated or the person in the correction system themselves, whether they're paying for their own ankle monitoring bracelet or they're, with respect to an incarceration facility, whether they're paying exorbitant fees for money transfers or very exorbitant fees for video visitation, these kinds of things. That is something that I don't think we should tolerate, that the money is shifted onto the burden, onto the individual. The individual is already, serving their sentence and their debt to society. They shouldn't have to go into debt as well just to get the services in a public facility wouldn't be as exorbitant.
But Arjun, let me say that what David describes there is going on in state-run facilities as well. NPR did a great series on this. There's a lot of the cost that's falling on the shoulders of the prisoner and their families, and that's going on throughout our prison system, isn't it?
Absolutely. And again, I think it's just important to emphasize that, right, I mean, big picture, the United States is home to 5% of the world's total population, but houses 25% of its prisoners. So private prisons are clearly a problem, but so is the United States' general reliance on incarceration. And one of the problems that we've seen is that increasingly prisoners are asked to bear the costs mm-hmm. of their incarceration. So, yeah, private prisons and the policies that flow from them are certainly problematic, but it's one sliver of a larger problem.
A call here from Steve in Stanchfield, Minnesota. Steve, it sounds like you've got some experience in the corrections division. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, I worked 7 years as a deputy sheriff in a county jail, mm-hmm. among other things, and 9 years as an RN in maximum security and supermax prisons in Minnesota. And I knew quite a few officers and some nurses that moved to Prairie Correction Facility, which has since been closed, and it was a nightmare. They were lied to. The pay was low. The benefits were very poor. Officers became involved in smuggling in drugs. There was a much higher level of violence, both among offenders and offenders to correctional officers. And I believe that's part of the reason that it closed, but it was an absolute disaster. And I think that's pretty much, from what I've heard in the community, that's been a nationwide experience. It's just a lousy system.
Steve, you would know the answer to this. I mean, the things that you mentioned, the drugs in prisons, well, we know, again, that those happen in state and municipal-run facilities. Some of the corruption, some of the violence. I mean, is your concern that these are even deeper problems, deeper versions of the same problems that we have in a lot of our facilities?
Yes. I mean, it's, one of your guests had mentioned, or several of your guests had mentioned, that the turnover of correctional staff in these places because of poor pay and benefits. And that right. just makes officers more vulnerable to pressure or coercion or rewards. I know it's a problem in Minnesota. I worked at the prison in Rush City and at Oak Park Heights, and there it was a minimal problem. The state-run facilities, at least in this state, are generally pretty clean. There's always going to be a problem, but it was nothing like what I was told by coworkers that went to work for Prairie. It was much, much, much worse there.
Good to have your experience with this. David, what would you say to that?
Yeah, I think your caller is absolutely right. The averages, the last time I checked, was that private prison facilities, the corrections officers get something like 20% less in wages than in a publicly run facility. And that just creates more temptation. I mean, it just creates more of an ability to know that in order to get the wages that are commensurate with that level, maybe you're smuggling in contraband, maybe you're using your power over the inmates to try to gain an advantage, and so the combination of low wages, a lack of training, and a lack of equipment. Which is another thing that you see in these privately run facilities, creates an environment that I think can lead to the types of things that your caller was mentioning.
Arjun, one of the things that I had a hard time finding was a direct comparison between recidivist rates between private prisons and state-run or municipal-run facilities. Do you have those numbers, or where would we find those?
I do not have those numbers offhand. Again, anecdotally, there is strong evidence that shows that recidivism in the context of private prisons is higher for a whole host of reasons. Again, the Department of Justice OIG report has found that private prisons incurred more safety and security incidents per capita than other private prisons, right? And unsafe conditions lead to things like recidivism. Poor level of care leads to things like recidivism. Mm-hmm. So does poor programming, right? I mean, it used to be that some facilities, for example, had trade schools or opportunities for work for prisoners. But with private prisons, those opportunities often don't exist. And it's things like that impede rehabilitation and that lead to recidivism.
David, do you have a perspective on this? I'm not sure why those numbers are hard to come by. Maybe you know.
Well, I will say, just as a general matter, that one problem with the private prison industry is the relative lack of transparency.
I see.
Unlike with a publicly run facility where they are subject to state public records laws and various forms of transparency, a private facility has used various loopholes to get out of reporting requirements. That includes reporting incidences of violence. It's very hard to get that information. That includes issues around health care and incidents around that. And it could also include recidivism rates. So, you know, as a general matter, one other sort of overlooked point here is that when you have a private prison facility, you're not getting that same level of transparency.
Call here from Christine in Minneapolis. Hey, Christine, good morning.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sounds like you have some experience with this.
Yeah, and it may speak to this recidivism question, too. This is personal experience in that my brother, back in the 90s, was kind of young and dumb, got in trouble with law and was sent to prison. Mm-hmm. And at one point, without our family being notified, was moved, and we were living in a different state to start with, but the family really tried to support him. And I think that family and community support is really important for reintegration, rehabilitation, helping people come out and be able to be productive members of society. So he was transferred overnight to a private prison three states away, which essentially cut off all of his outside support and connection.
Wow.
He ultimately did come back to the state we lived in, and was released and is doing well, thankfully, not without a lot of difficulty. That being a felon makes it hard to work, things like that. But I think that's something that should be factored in, too, that there can be a real severing of one's social supports and connections in a situation like this. That was our family's experience.
What has he said about his experience of being, if anything, about the difference between being in the private prison and the state-run one?
You know, when this program started this morning, I thought, oh, I wish I could reach him right now and ask him. It's been a couple of decades, and he doesn't talk a lot about his time in general in prison, but I do want to ask him more about that. My main memory is just that he lost his connection with all of us. I mean, we could still sometimes talk with him on the phone, but, you know, that's my main memory at the time.
I'm really glad you heard the show and you had a chance to call in, Christine. Thank you. To Kevin in Minneapolis. Hi, Kevin.
Hey there.
Hi. What's your question?
I wanted to pick up on the conversation around metrics and such and ask, I mean, is there a commonly accepted set of metrics for success or failure in prisons? And where do we find that? So do your guests have a website where we can see that? Or
sure.
Is there a common place on the government site that we can look it up?
Arjun, that's a really good question. What would you say?
You know, really quickly, I wanted to revisit the caller just before this because she made an important point.
Sure.
I don't want to lose sight of it. What some call incarceration across state lines, what we have found is exactly what her brother experienced, which is that states and private prisons are increasingly sending inmates out of state to other facilities. So, for example...
And why would they do that, though, Arjun?
Well, in the case of California, for example, right? So California, under the Supreme Court found some years ago that California's prisons were overcrowded, right? And they weren't complying with basic due process standards. So one of the things that California did to reduce its prison population was to actually send prisoners across state lines. So there are now prisoners who were charged and convicted for offenses in California who are now housed in Arizona, Oklahoma, Mississippi, right? So that obviously impedes rehabilitation, and that rewards profiteers. So I think that's an important point. David, did you want to jump in on the question that was just asked?
Yeah, David, it was about how do we measure success and where would we find some of that information?
Well, I think that was sort of the impetus behind the report that the Department of Justice put out, evaluating its own facilities and looking at the difference between the privately run ones and the ones run by the federal Bureau of Prisons. So that's a decent place to start. As I said before, it's a very kind of opaque system when you're trying to get information out of these private prison facilities. There was, just to tout another journalist, there was an incredible series at Mother Jones Magazine.
Oh, right.
A guy named Shane Bauer spent 3 months as a private prison guard and detailed his experiences in a very long, almost a book-length article, I think 30, 40,000 words. And it is extremely illuminating as to what life is really like for a guard inside one of these facilities.
Steph Curtis is going to grab a link to this Mother Jones series. I read a part of it as I prepared for this conversation. You can find that link at nprnews.org/live when she puts it up there. Conversation and a focus for this month on criminal justice. On Tuesdays, you'll hear conversations about criminal justice, different dimensions of it. You're going to hear from judges and advocates and attorneys and activists. And then we have a special Friday roundtable planned on this. We are beginning, as you hear this morning, with private prisons and asking about their motivation, the monitoring of the way private prisons are run, why the Justice Department has decided to phase out its use of private prisons, what it means that Immigrations and Customs are expanding their use of private prisons. We'll talk about that in just a minute. David Dayan, Arjun Sethi with us this morning. And your questions and your thoughts, if you have a family member, as we heard from Christine, who's had some experience with this, or you've had some experience with this, I'd like to hear about that. And if you're an attorney, you're somebody who has worked in the correction system, worked in the administrative part of it, or perhaps as a guard in one of these facilities, it would be very valuable to us to hear your experience as well. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, always on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. News now, and then right back to your calls and your questions. Hey, John, what are you leading with this hour?
Oh, Carrie, it's a story involving President-elect Donald Trump and Twitter. President-elect Trump is threatening to slap a tax on General Motors for importing compact cars to the U.S. from Mexico. Trump tweeted today that GM is sending Mexican-made Cruises to the U.S. tax-free. He told GM to stop or pay a big border tax, but GM says all of its Cruise sedans sold in the U.S. are now made in Ohio and that they're only importing the hatchbacks, and that's a small percentage of the Cruises sold. Still, shares of GM fell about 1% immediately after the tweet, but then recovered. Senior House Republicans say a vote is scheduled for Thursday on a measure that reaffirms U.S. support for Israel. It comes after the Obama administration refused to veto a United Nations resolution criticizing the Middle East ally on settlements. Republicans say the administration, quote, has lost all credibility when it comes to Israel. Secretary of State John Kerry said last month that the U.S. was standing up for a two-state solution when it abstained on the resolution instead of vetoing it. Forecasters are trying to determine whether a tornado caused four of the five deaths that resulted from the storms that left a path of destruction across the southeast. Teams are headed out today to assess apparent tornado damage at three sites in southeastern Alabama and southwestern Georgia. In addition to the four deaths in Alabama, a Florida man died in flooding in the Florida Panhandle. A strong opening on Wall Street. It is led by big gains in banks and energy company, major U.S. indexes, broadly higher in the opening trading. The price of crude oil is up about, now over 2%, and the Dow up 0.7%, the NASDAQ up just under 1%, the S&P 500 up 0.8%. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Stephanie Curtis.
And I'm Ewan Kerr. We're The Cube Critics.
We talk movies twice a week on The Cube Critics podcast.
Find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, and while we're talking about podcasts, on the podcast right now, the biggest book show of 2016. Right there, if you missed it, if you haven't seen the list on the thread, you can find the whole show on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Kerry Miller wherever you get your podcasts. And our criminal justice series will be there through the month. If you miss these shows, you can always go right to the podcast and hear what we're talking about. NPR News with Kerry Miller on iTunes.
I'm Krista Tippett, the host of On Being. We're located right here on Loring Park in Minneapolis, taking up the big questions at the center of human life. You can listen to On Being Sunday mornings at 6 and again at 7 Sunday night on NPR News.
Back to our conversation now about private prisons. David Dayan with us and Arjun Sethi with us. And gentlemen, two different views here on rehabilitation. Pierre tweets, once we privatize prisons, where is the incentive in the industry to reduce crime or rehabilitate? More crime, more profit. And then we heard from John in Minneapolis, who couldn't stay on the line, but he says, I work for Legal Action Center. Punishment is for the victim. It has to be part of the discussion in terms of rehabilitation. In terms of maladaptive behavior, private prisons tend to be more flexible with rehabilitation, more effective incarceration processes. Arjun, how would you respond to both of those?
I mean, I certainly agree with Pierre's observation. The moment that you profitize rehabilitation is the moment it ceases to exist, because private prisons profit from recidivism, which is, I believe, one of the reasons that you continue to see higher incidence of safety and security issues in those facilities in comparison to, for example, state and federal prisons. You know, with respect to victims' rights and victim justice, I would just say that there are a whole host of ways that victims can be made whole. They can be made whole through money damages. They can be made whole through just a whole variety of means. I don't believe that lengthy sentences are a way of doing that and a way of making victims whole. I just have a different view of rehabilitation and the criminal justice system.
David, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, one thing I would say, if you're looking, and this maybe gets back to a point from before, if you're looking for reasons why these private facilities prosper and why they take in so many inmates, the profit motive isn't only on the part of that facility, but for many of these small towns and cities and counties where these prison facilities are located, there are these things called intergovernmental service agreements. Usually they're confidential, but we've gotten to see some of them. And they give essentially kickbacks to the city or county for the number of prisoners at that facility. In one facility in Colorado, it's $2 per prisoner per day. And so that creates incentives at the city and county level to keep people within the system. And that is almost more dangerous than having, you know, because not only are you introducing the profit motive for the company, but you're translating that to the city and county level. And obviously, these cities and counties are many of them are cash strapped. There are some small towns where the inmates at the facility are half of the population of that town. And so I think that's another part and dimension to this entire conversation.
And Arjun, do you? I've mentioned this immigration and customs issue where they are going to be apparently needing more space in private prisons. What concerns you about that, besides some of the issues that we've raised in general about them for this particular population?
Sure. Well, I mean, again, big picture. Immigration violations are civil offenses, right, under the law. These are not crimes.
Right.
So, for example, if somebody overstays their visa or their visa expires or they are engaged in unauthorized work, why are those individuals being incarcerated, right, let alone in private facilities? So it is my belief that undocumented immigrants who are apprehended should be treated with dignity and respect. By no means should they be incarcerated and subject to the brutal conditions, you know, of private facilities. And as I believe pointed out earlier, there are roughly, I believe, more than 300,000 undocumented immigrants currently in private prison facilities.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge issue. And in some ways, the DOJ order from last summer is really just nibbling around the edges. The much larger issue are states who contract with private prisons. And as you correctly point out, ISIS contracts with private prisons.
And David, I'm sure you noted that upon the election of Donald Trump, the stock prices of these three largest private prison companies went up, apparently with the assumption that they're now going to be used to house more undocumented people in the U.S.
Well, it's a pretty good assumption. There's certainly Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail was talking about phasing out not just privately run prisons at the federal level, but encouraging those efforts at the state level and with respect to immigrant detention. Donald Trump certainly has not made the same claim. In fact, before the election, two advisors to or former advisors to Jeff Sessions, who is the attorney general nominee, went to work as lobbyists for CoreCivic. So it is very strongly supposed that whatever was done at the Justice Department level to phase out these facilities will be reversed. Actually, it was almost reversed even beforehand because the Justice Department, even despite the Yates memo, renewed a contract with CoreCivic rather than phasing it out. So there's some sense that this Justice Department initiative was a lot of talk and a little less action.
A call here from Craig in Burnsville. Hi, Craig. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. You're welcome. I have an interesting experience. A number of years ago, our Department of Corrections impaneled a Citizens Advisory Committee. Mm-hmm. As a consequence of that committee, I've served, so to speak, served in all of the state's prisons. I think I have an experience with them as well as with the Department of Corrections. Relationship with the Corrections Corporation of America in their Appleton event.
And what did you find?
I can't believe
Craig.
We're going back. Well, I just can't believe that we're going back down the same road of failure that we had a decade or so ago. Private installations don't work well for the communities they serve, nor for the inmates that they house. And finally, I think to the issue that as a democracy, we have to assume complete responsibility for those people that we assume to incarcerate and not turn it over to a private business to make money on.
Craig, I appreciate the call. Arjun, I sense that you'd agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is sad that we are still having to argue about the usefulness and the morality of private prisons in the year 2017. This is an industry whose doors should have been shuttered really a long time ago, but we have found that they are a powerful industry, that they are a smart industry, and that they are willing to invest a lot of money in lobbying for harsher penalties, for bed quotas, and expand into new areas like immigration enforcement and the treatment industrial complex. And to effectively curb the use of private prisons, it's going to require an ongoing and enduring struggle.
Arjun, I really appreciate your insight and your experience on this, bringing that to the conversation. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And David, I'm really grateful for your reporting on this. It helped prepare me and inform me for the discussion. So thanks so much for being a part of the conversation.
Okay, thanks. It was fun.
Next Tuesday, we're going to talk about women in prison as our criminal justice series for January continues. I'm Carrie Miller. We've been talking this hour about private prisons. Now we're going to hear about another different prison, and that's Guantanamo Bay. President Obama has long wanted to close Guantanamo, but there are still 59 detainees at the prison camp, 23 of whom have been cleared. Now the Obama administration is racing to send those cleared detainees to third-party countries before Donald Trump is sworn into office. Here's Miami Herald reporter Carol Rosenberg talking to NPR's Rachel Martin about the detention center.
Some of these countries have gotten a little squishy, let's say. There's a new president coming, Donald Trump. He has a new vision for Guantanamo, He says that he wants to load it up. He says that he has no intention of closing it. So some of the countries, it seems that they're a little bit uncertain about whether they want to please the departing president and continue these deals and resettle the men who were cleared to go, or they want to wait and see a little bit the lay of the land of what's going to happen when Donald Trump becomes president.
Do we have any idea at this point whether or not he wants to continue reviewing the cases of the people who are currently in Gitmo, or does he just want to do away with that altogether?
The answer is I don't know. And if you find someone who knows, they should give me a call, because we know very little beyond what Donald Trump said during his campaign about what he intends to do with Guantanamo. I think what you're getting at, Rachel, is if we have review boards and the review boards approve people for release with security guarantees and this administration doesn't want to release them, what do you have down there? You have 10 men currently who are charged with crimes, facing trials, 6 death penalty trials. You have these 23 who are cleared, some of whom will get to go before Obama leaves the White House. And then you have what we call the forever prisoners, 26 men whom the boards have decided are too dangerous to release, but for whom there's no crime that they found to charge them with. And we don't know in the next administration what will become of these people.
So what does that mean, Carol, that they can't be charged with anything, that there's just no evidence to charge some of these people who are knowingly connected to terrorist organizations?
So you have to remember that Guantanamo was set up as a kind of POW location. They didn't call them POWs because they didn't want to give them all the privileges. They wanted to be able to interrogate them, and they wanted to be able to deny them certain aspects of the Geneva Conventions. But the short answer is, they're war prisoners, but you have to have found an act, a crime, a war crime under the international laws of war to charge them with.
It's not enough to just be a foot soldier for Al-Qaeda or some affiliate. You have to be connected to a specific act of terror.
And the courts have proven that in the intervening years. You know, the Bush administration set up military commissions, and they intended to charge all these foot soldiers with something called material support for terror. And in the intervening years, the federal courts have said that's not a war crime. In a way, that's a little bit the irony of Guantanamo, because that is a crime in federal court. Had they brought these men into federal court, they probably would have been able to charge them in many instances with being foot soldiers. They can't at Guantanamo.
President Obama campaigned in 2008 on a promise to close Gitmo. He spent 8 years trying to make that happen. Why did he fail in the end, do you think?
The short answer is that Congress made it impossible for him to do it. But the long answer is, when he came into office, he thought he was going to look at the prisoners of Guantanamo and either try them or let them go. But he realized that there was a third category, these forever prisoners, people he couldn't put on trial, people he was unwilling and his administration was unwilling to send away to other places. So it became, to close Guantanamo meant to move Guantanamo, to pick up these forever prisoners and the people who would be charged and move them to the United States, what we call Guantanamo North, create Guantanamo on U.S. soil. Congress systematically blocked that. And when you can't move Guantanamo, you can't close Guantanamo.
That's my Miami Herald reporter Carol Rosenberg talking to NPR's Rachel Martin about Guantanamo Bay. We're turning now to Europe and our partners at the BBC. Donald Trump has indicated, sometimes via Twitter, that there may be major foreign policy changes enacted as soon as he's sworn in. So what would this mean for Europe, Russia, and NATO? Here's the BBC's Chris Morris on that.
Fans of Donald Trump celebrated his election victory last month. But this wasn't Michigan or Mississippi or even midtown Manhattan. It was Moscow. On the campaign trail, Mr. Trump had been open about his admiration for Vladimir Putin.
If he says great things about me, I'm going to say great things about him. I've already said he is really very much of a leader.
And the Russian president has been happy to respond.
During my recent telephone conversation with Donald Trump, we agreed that the unsatisfying state that Russian-American relations are in today needs to be rectified.
So there is talk of a reset in U.S.-Russian relations, a major policy shift. And all this against the background of American intelligence evidence that Russia used cyber attacks to influence the U.S. presidential election. Republican Senator John McCain, appearing on CNN, suggested that the incoming Republican president would not have everything his own way.
There's no doubt they were interfering, and no doubt it was a cyber attack. The question now is how much and what damage and what should the United States of America do?
The fear among many European governments is that Mr. Trump might choose to ignore this gathering storm and ease sanctions against Russia as a gesture of goodwill. But Jan Tekau of the Holbrooke Foundation in Berlin says the main concern is how he will respond to his first test.
Mr. Putin most likely will try to find out how he ticks once he is president. Some sort of crisis, some sort of escalation, some sort of minor thing to which he has to react. And much will depend on, you know, on the Trump that then emerges. Will the behavior of Trump encourage others to do similar things, you know, or will Trump actually buy into the raison d'etat of American, you know, traditional foreign policy and defend the lines, you know, that were established?
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Mr. Donald J. Trump.
That's so nice. Thank you.
To put it another way, will Mr. Trump choose to govern in the way that he campaigned?
What I'm saying is NATO is obsolete and it's extremely expensive to the United States.
He went further, suggesting that NATO countries that don't pay their way by meeting the target of spending 2% of GDP on defense shouldn't assume that the US would come to their aid if they were to be attacked. Does he mean it? The president-elect has chosen to surround himself with military people who may think NATO should change but are also committed to it. Sheer unpredictability, though, as the former diplomat Robert Cooper points out, has become a hallmark of the Trump phenomenon.
I think the point to understand is that if all of these things were executed at the extreme end of what was said with the campaign, then it's a revolution. The world we live in is a world that America made post-war. NATO, the European Union, that's the world that America made. Removing all of those things is a revolution.
But Evelyn Farkas from the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., who was a senior Pentagon official during the Obama administration, says it's up to Europe to respond.
Somebody in Europe has to stand up and say, okay, listen, we're going to maintain NATO. We're not going to let Russia divide us. I predict eventually the reset will fall apart because we'll run out of things that we can cooperate with the Russians on. And then we'll come back and be stronger together.
But still, the big unnerving question is left hanging. Will the American security guarantee hold? Governments across Europe are working hard to try to convince the incoming administration that it should.
Chris Morris there from the BBC reporting on Europe, Russia, NATO's anticipation of a Trump presidency. Another bit of news here from the BBC. The UK's ambassador to the EU, Sir Ivan Rogers, has resigned. He was appointed to the job by David Cameron in 2013. He'd been expected to play a key role in Brexit talks, which are due to start within the next couple of months. But here's the thing. Rogers had told the BBC and had told some ministers that he thought a UK-EU trade deal could take 10 years. And he got a lot of criticism for that. He told them this was also the view of the EU's other 27 member states. 2017, bringing in those negotiations over Brexit. You'll be hearing news about that right here on NPR News with Carrie Miller.